House Committee on Government Efficiency together, and in an effort to be efficient, I'm going to give you the order in which we're going to take these bills. This is in, after long negotiations with the Treasurer's Office. No, I'm just kidding, not long negotiations. We're going to do 2119 first, because we have someone that we're going to call that's going to give testimony over the phone. We're going to take 2116 second, which is the stabilization fund. Then we're going to go to 2121, and then 2122, and then we'll take up 2117 last, or on and any other bills that we don't get to today, we'll take up on Thursday. So just to kind of give you a heads up on what order we're going to do things, and with that, we'll get started. I'm going to open the public hearing on House Bill 2119, and Matt, would you give us a little rundown on this, please?
House Bill 2119 allows the Oregon Growth Account Board to contract with management companies outside of Oregon. It requires that the management companies invest in Oregon companies an amount equal to the Oregon Growth Account principal, and it exempts the Oregon Growth Board from public contracts and purchasing laws, suggests guidelines for investment policies.
Okay, and we have with us State Treasurer, and why don't you come on up? Will you let me know when we're supposed to call?
Sure.
We're supposed to call?
At any time, there's a gentleman that's on the phone. There's a gentleman right now on the who's ready to be called if we want to call him now.
Okay.
Keith Barnes.
Okay.
He's a board member.
Sure.
You want to do that now?
Do you want to have him called first?
Why don't we have him testify, and then I'd be happy to go after him.
That's fine.
Technology.
It's
gotta be good.
See,
I'm gonna get on the first one.
That's the
efficiency.
Kind of an adult. I'm just going on the number.
You're in trouble.
I would just suspect anything like that.
Hello.
Is this Peggy?
No, do you need to speak with Peggy Harding?
Actually, I'm looking for Keith Barnes.
Thank you.
Something odd about me having a conversation on the public record. I'm trying to trick somebody down.
Good morning, Mr. Barnes' office.
Is Mr. Barnes in?
Yes, he is. My son was calling.
This is Matt Winger, the committee administrator.
Oh, thank you for calling. Hold on, he'll be right with you.
Good morning.
Mr. Barnes?
Yes.
I'm going to turn you over here to the chairman of the House Government Efficiency Committee.
Okay.
Hi, Mr. Barnes. This is Representative Jerry Krummel. I'm the chair of House Government Efficiency.
Good morning.
Good morning. And we have started a hearing on House Bill 2119, which is the one that deals with Oregon Growth Account Board.
Correct.
And I understand that you want to testify, and so what we'd like to do is go ahead and allow you to testify. Before you hang up, I would like you to hang tight to see if there's any questions that anybody else on the committee might have.
Certainly.
Okay. So go ahead, sir.
Okay. Well, first of all, I think I might just take a minute or two to give you some background on the Oregon Growth Account and why we started it and how it's organized. Back in 1993, I was the chairman of the American Electronics Association. That is, of course, a night job, not a full-time job. I am chairman and CEO of a company called Integrated Measurement Systems in Beaverton. But in any regard, as I was chairing the AEA in Oregon, a number of companies were approaching the American Electronics Association and letting us know that venture capital for startups in the state of Oregon was in jeopardy. And as we looked into it, we were able to get the three major accounting firms, Arthur Andersen, KPMG, and Price Waterhouse, to pull together a report which took a look at the historical investments in startup companies in Oregon from, I think it was the 83 through 88 period, in which there was about a half a billion dollars, it's $500 million invested in the state of Oregon in startup companies like Mentor Graphics, Protocol, Integrated Measurement Systems, Sequent Computer, and a number of the companies that people know pretty well. From the period of about 1988 through 1993, that next five-year period, there was a very difficult time for the venture capitalists being able to raise money from their limited partners. And in fact, in Oregon, several of them ceased to operate, largely because their limited partners were often the banks, and the banks were running into trouble from bad real estate loans. And you may remember that there was a period there where capital formation on the debt side was very difficult for companies in the state of Oregon. So a number of us took a look at this, and when Governor Kitzhaber came into office, he formed a transition team with a broad group of people from a number of industries to take a look at the problem, and we reported back that there was not only a problem in debt layer financing, but also in the venture area and mezzanine as well. So about 1995, I guess, we started to, and this is a broad group of people, so this is, you know, not a partisan issue. It was a very bipartisan group that, that was pulled together, decided to advance a bill with the help of a number of people and their input from Gordon Smith to Jim Hill, the treasurer, and of course the governor, to start the Oregon Growth Account. And the idea here is pretty simple. We're taking a very small portion of the lottery and making sure that we qualify competent fund managers to make investments principally in Oregon in growth-oriented companies. And it could be a broad base of different types of industries, but they have to be growth-oriented and have to be companies that we believe, or the managers believe, will give back a risk-adjusted rate of return. So these are this is not a funding of last resort. This is a true profit-driven business model. And when these companies are funded and the proceeds come back, from the distributions, whether these companies are acquired or whether they go public or whatever their liquidity event is, the monies from that get redistributed per the policy that's in the bill that's in front of you. And so the idea here was to keep the pump primed in Oregon because this small amount of money that we're putting here is leveraged in a number of ways. First of all, there are investments made by the fund managers that are selected, and that money goes into the companies in Oregon. But also, these fund managers will go to the SBIC and in many cases raise two times the money that's put into their fund by us. So if they raise $5 million here, they'll go get $10 million from the SBIC. And so there's a substantial leverage from the federal government there. The other thing that they will do is they will participate with other venture capitalists in California and other states, and we expect that the leverage that that will provide will be somewhere in the order of four or five times what is invested by them in the state. Without these people, the venture capitalists in the other states wouldn't even consider coming to Oregon because they want to have local people here who could sit on the boards of these companies and watch their investments for them as a lead venture capitalist. So that's kind of the background on this. We have selected now several managers who are making investments into Oregon companies, and as I understand it, the first liquidity events are starting to happen, and the first returns from those we would expect should be seen starting in the year 2001. So I think this bill does a couple of things. First of all, it establishes that other fund managers may be selected outside of the state so long as they principally invest in Oregon with the monies that they're given as an LP. And the second thing is it defines the policy for distribution of the profits coming from the Oregon Growth Account investments.
Is that the end of your testimony?
It's pretty much the end of it. If I can answer any questions for you, I feel pleased to do so.
Okay, great. Are there any questions from the committee for Mr. Barnes? Well, there are not any hands going up.
Okay.
So I would like to thank you for being available this morning to testify, even though you couldn't actually be here in person. And I think we got everything on the record.
Well, thanks very much. I wish I could have been there to meet you all, but unfortunately I'm sandwiching in between two telephone conferences, and I do appreciate your time and considering this bill.
Sure. Thank you very much.
You bet.
Have a nice day.
Thanks. You too. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. The Treasurer?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, my name is Randall Edwards, State Treasurer of Oregon, and thank you for the opportunity to be here today. Keith Barnes, just so you know, is on the Oregon Growth Account Board. I'm the chair of that board, and he's got a long tenure in looking at investments in technology, and is the CEO, I don't know if you heard that, of Integrated Management Systems, which is a company that's really one of the stars here in Oregon. Since Keith kind of gave you an overlay of the history of this bill, I thought of the Oregon Growth Account, I'd just give you a couple of takes on what we do in the Treasury, why this bill, a little bit about why we created this bill, but also some specifics. And with me is Linda Haglund, my Deputy State Treasurer, who could answer some additional questions you may have about the investments we've made under this program. As Keith was describing, this account was created in 1995 to help provide returns to the Educational Endowment Fund to make investments in emerging businesses, and later on affordable housing was put into that mix as well. The account, as Keith was describing, was to address a capital gap somewhere estimated between $100 and $200 million. The account was established within the Educational Endowment Fund, it receives approximately 10% of the 15% of the lottery revenue that is directed into the Educational Endowment Fund. So there's a constant stream of money coming into this fund, which is approximately $8 million a year. The board that's created under the Oregon Growth Account uses the funds to enter into partnerships with other investors to fund emerging businesses and, again, as I mentioned, affordable housing. To date, the board has entered into about four partnerships relating to emerging businesses, including a venture capital firm that focuses on early-stage information technology investments and a partnership that provides mezzanine financing to small businesses. The board must enter currently the way the law is written, and the reason why we're before you is currently the way the law is written, we must enter into partnerships with management companies that exist here solely in Oregon to make these investments. And again, let me underscore the whole intent of this account is to put money into Oregon, not into other states. What we're trying to do here is help expand our partnership by being able to go out and find partners outside of Oregon, but again, directing that the monies that we would partner with them would come back to the state in this equal amount. So there's no changing of the mandate of this the Oregon Growth Account. Again, there is no bright line about how we invest these monies other than the thrust is to put them here in the state. The bill outlines, as Keith was describing, some investment policies that I as Treasurer can develop, including the reinvestment of principal and returns, retention of amounts for refund of unfunded commitments owed to management companies, and determining when and how earnings are calculated and declared available. Those are some of the specifics about the bill. It really is a housekeeping bill to help us make sure that we are managing these monies and finding the best investments here in Oregon and to help a need in the state. I'd be happy to answer any questions you may have about that. Thank you for letting Keith go first because he's a very busy person.
Okay. Representative Tomei.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Randall, can you? I have a couple of questions. What is mezzanine capital?
Want to answer
that? Sure. Sure. I'll answer. Mr. Chair, Representative Tomei, Linda Haglund, Deputy State Treasurer. And mezzanine capital typically is, if you can think of it as a source of loan funds, and in a private equity partnership, it's a loan and then typically has some feature of an equity kicker or an equity ownership, so it's a two-part financing to a corporation. That didn't, no, okay. Mezzanine financing, instead of a buyout, so providing funds to actually purchase the company, the partnership will partner with the company and provide loan money to them. So bridging, providing financing to complete an activity with typical loan terms, so an interest rate and a maturity, so like a regular loan. And then as a added kicker to that loan, they'll take equity back, they'll take shares back in the company. So the hope is that the partnership will invest in the company, provide loan financing, so they'll continue with their business practices, and by that improving the business, then the stock will, of course, be worth more, and then the partnership, by owning the stock, will have a higher rate of return.
Follow-up, Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Tomei.
Thank you. So then would they sell back the stock at the end of this process?
The partnership would have the ability then to liquidate the shares on the open market.
If I might, just it's a financing technique to get some getting money to early stage in a company's life, and it's a way in which you can position yourself as a partner by through a loan, and then you get, in addition to the loan, which is the money to help build the company, you get equity shares into that company, and then if they go public and they're bought on the marketplace, which is sort of the bet in the end, then you have an asset that's worth some money. So it's just part of the venture capital financing. It's a financing technique to get money into early stage companies.
Okay, thank you. Yep.
Did you have another question?
Yes, I do. So the management company is invested in Oregon, even though the company may not be. Can you give me an example of that, please?
Could you repeat the question? You're saying the question was, is the way this bill, what the bill does is it says the company may not be headquartered in Oregon. I mean, basically an outside entity that we may partner with the money. We will be a limited partner in a fund, for example. Mm-hmm. Somebody else, let's say somebody in Seattle is putting a fund together to put money in a venture capital investment throughout the Northwest. Right now, the way the bill works, we could not partner with them because they are not headquartered in Oregon, for example. So therefore, we couldn't be a partner in this fund to make investments in startup companies in Oregon because they're not in Oregon. So what this bill says is if we invest in a company in Seattle that's setting up this fund, we can do that, one, and two, we will also guarantee that that money is directly invested back into Oregon and not into any other Northwest companies. So but we're not changing the mandate of the Oregon Growth Account. We're just expanding the ability to find partners outside of the state. And that was something that when we went into this program, we're finding that to get other partnerships, we really need to get outside of the state to find additional money to make those investments into the state.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Representative Tomei.
Thank you. So can you give me an example of that? The money transferred in the Oregon Growth Account to the management company is invested in Oregon, even though the company may not be. Can you give me a concrete example of a company that might be, say, from Seattle, but they're investing in Oregon?
Actually, I can't in this particular program because of the way it's currently structured that the management companies must reside within the state.
Okay.
I can give a parallel to you, though.
Thank you.
In the Oregon Public Employees Retirement Fund, which is also managed by the Oregon Investment Council, the treasurer, and the treasury, we have a very large private equity portfolio, of which one of our partnerships is Olympic Venture Partners, and they are headquartered in the Seattle area. Pardon me. And they make investments in companies throughout the Northwest region. And I can't come up with a company specifically in Oregon, but the gist of it is that they're headquartered in Washington and actually look at companies in the region of which Oregon, there are investments of companies in Oregon. There's a number of them in the Portland region that are headquartered in Portland. And maybe just to say a little different way what Treasurer Edwards is trying to bring out, the purpose of the general partner, what we're doing, the management firms, is we're trying to hire a group of people who then have the mandate to go out and find the investments. So through the partner. In Oregon, exactly so.
Thank you.
So instead of having the focus being the management company being headquartered in Oregon, that portion isn't as important as the direction of where they will be investing the funds in the partnership, so the money that actually goes to the individual companies themselves.
Just may I add to that, Mr. Chair? Basically, what we're talking about are firms out there who go out and raise money and then invest it, and they create a pool of money. And those investors are limited partners. So in this case, yours, or in this case, we would be a limited partner in this pool. We would give up, say, $10 million or $5 million into this fund. They may be raising $50 to $100 million. They take that money, and then they go out and find investments to make returns. And that's, in essence, in venture capital, if you're looking at earlier stage, sort of looking for big hits, that these people have great ideas that will eventually become potentially the Microsofts of the future. I mean, in essence, that's kind of what we're trying to do, is be able to partner with those firms that are putting these monies together outside of the state, which is a limitation right now. We can't go outside of Oregon.
Great. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mm-hmm. Representative Gould.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good morning. Mr. Edwards, part of what this bill does exempts Oregon Growth Board from public contracts and purchasing laws. Is that correct? And could you explain that, please?
Could you specify what part of the bill you're talking about?
I don't know. It's on my preliminary measure summary.
Mm-hmm. Did you get a copy of the measure summary?
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
That's one of my questions. It is page 2, line 1. By changing the references to the and exempting the whole chapter, the chapter 279 is the public contracting chapter. It used to be recycling requirements. They're exempt from recycling exemptions from state purchasing guidelines under the sort of the broad, strange set of ORS statutes. 279 is, this would say that you would not have to go out and do any competitive bids. You could just contract without any standards.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Hill.
Thank you for answering that.
I don't think you answered the question.
Yeah.
I'm scared.
Did you have anything that you wanted to add to that? Or?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Hill outlined the law. I'd have to get back to you specifically about the intent of that change. The current statute, I'm not familiar with the 279-545 and 279-746.
Okay. Did you, Representative Gerard, did you have any other questions? Or
no.
And that satisfies your, that answers your question?
Well, it just tells me what it does, yes.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You're welcome. Let's see. Representative Hill.
Can you, how much money have we invested so far?
Mm-hmm. We've actually committed $19 million to 4 different partnerships. And if I could expand on that just a moment, we've made those commitments, and then a bit getting back to how the management company works relative to finding investments. They now have that pool of money committed to their partnerships and then have a period of time to deploy it and actually make the investment. So while we've committed 19, we haven't spent 19.
What is the available capital?
I have a number as of a few weeks ago. We have about $10 million.
Additional?
That's uncommitted. Mm-hmm.
And if I understood, we're going to see the first sort of liquidity events occur and the first set of returns. Is that what Mr. Barnes said?
Mr. Barnes would be more familiar with the status of the partnerships, how the partnerships work. Again, the management company finds a company to invest in, makes that investment, and then works with the firm to develop its business process, help it mature, and then the partnership either finds a strategic buyer, another company to take out their position, or issues the stock publicly and sells it. Or we could have, again, in a mezzanine situation, as the earlier question, where a loan would mature, so the principal would be coming back to the partnership. So there must be some type of an event that's to that point.
Do we have any numbers in terms of what we've leveraged, the investments on this, in terms of the $19 million that we've committed, whether that's been all out and invested or not? I'm just trying to understand what we've leveraged. Or are we just creating a cottage industry and we haven't attracted any additional capital into Oregon, or we've swapped capital out since?
Okay. In these same times?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Let me venture a guess at an answer here. We are a percentage participant in these funds. So, for example...
Just a little bit more. I think people in the back of the room are maybe having more time hearing you.
Okay, thank you. We are a limited partner in the funds, and therefore we are not the sole participant. So, for example, in one of the mezzanine investments that we have committed $1 million to that partnership. The entire partnership has raised a total of $20 million from other people. And the way a partnership works is, as limited partners, you're all investing the exact same way. So I guess to answer your question as far as leveraging, our $1 million going into that partnership, there's 19 other million put together that are coming into Oregon companies or other investments of the partnership.
Okay. So in that case, we've leveraged $1 million to help leverage 20 additional million to our partner.
That's getting to my question in terms of, so we're auditing, obviously, these investments so we understand, but since the firm doesn't have a restriction on the other $19 million, there's $1 million invested in Oregon, and they took the other $19 million and it's someplace else, or in this instance, it was $20 million into a fund, $1 million came out of this Oregon growth account, and all $20 million was invested in Oregon. So we've actually leveraged it versus we're just participating in a fund, and they found somebody to take $1 million, and $20 million went some other place, or you know, $19 million went, you know, some other place. That's what I'm trying to understand. In terms of, are we actually, is this program working in the sense that you have people out scouring the bushes looking for investments in Oregon, and we're attracting additional capital because we're here, you know, pushing dollars into the system?
I'm looking at this strategy summary. It doesn't state
that. Mr. Chair, Representative Hill, the general purpose of the fund that we're talking about, the 1 to 20, the Tamarack Mezzanine Partners, which is located in Portland, is primarily focused investing that $20 million in Oregon. So we are, I mean, that was the whole intent of this bill, and the whole intent of what our job is to try to leverage the money here in Oregon by expanding it to a partnership. I mean, you also realize outside of the state, in the end, you may not see all of that money come back in here in the sense of, let's just say Tamarack was in Seattle, but by being a partner, you're helping fund a fund that has the potential of bringing some of that money, which might not have been here, into the state as well. Because these are people on the ground, mostly in Oregon, Smart Venture, Smart Forest Ventures, Endeavor, Timberline Venture Partners in Portland. Again, they're pretty much geared towards looking at Oregon. And so what we're trying to do is expand our stable of managers, and that's what this bill does. Again, to leverage, like you're describing, getting more money put in here in the state.
Go ahead, Representative.
So. Is this now going to mean that will we see a rush to not use Oregon investment? You know, it's just sort of, we take away the prohibition of being someone else and making someone open an office in the state of Oregon. Is this now going to mean that we're going to go with, you know, we'll be spending our time down in San Jose and, you know, and investing in partnerships down there? If somebody's going to come up and make investments in Oregon, and so, you know, the airport will get an investment of flights coming in as they come and review it versus, you know, a focus in people on the ground in Oregon. How do we balance this out so that we don't lose sort of that intent that we actually start encouraging people to show up here, end up and seeing the creativity and the investments that can be had in the state of Oregon, but without losing the opportunity to participate in larger funds and is still leveraging a focus of these larger funds coming into Oregon and seeing what the opportunities are?
Well, first, Mr. Chair, Representative Hill, as chair of this board, I'll make sure that we don't dilute our investments in the state. In fact, that's the mandate of this board, and what I'm trying to do is make sure that we have as much money flowing into the state. And I'm looking at this amendment as an opportunity to help us leverage as a partner to make sure that we get money in here. So I hear your concern, but you've got my word. That's not what we're trying to do here. We are trying to get more money into the state and find other partners to do that. There's just a finite amount of folks in Oregon, quite frankly, that are doing this type of work. You could say, well, why don't you give these firms more money? Well, they knew what their funds were right now. They were looking for a limited partner. We came in and helped finance them. That isn't to say if they find investments, they use up, in this case, Tamarack uses it, $20 million in the next 5 to 6 to 7 years, and they come back and create another fund, that we wouldn't be there with them again. So it's not like this is the end of the only times we're going to invest in these firms. It's the first round.
Thank you.
Just a second. Representative March?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've got two questions, Mr. Treasurer. In limited partnerships generally involve a situation where the managing partner receives a percentage for their management, while you're receiving a percentage based on the amount of money you put in. Is that the case in this situation? In the situations that you're investing in?
Yes, that would be the case.
And is there a ballpark of what percentage management companies in this kind of situation charge?
Well, yes, and I won't speak specifically to these individual terms, but generally the marketplace, as you would see, a management fee that would run somewhere in the 1.5 plus or minus range, it might go up as high as 2%. And that just pays for the day-to-day operations of the fund. I might add that all of the partnerships that the Treasury invests in require that before the general partner receives any profit out of the fund, that those management fees are returned. So while we pay them out, it's almost like a short-term loan for them, so we get the management fee back. Then the second portion of the partnership is the actual profits that are generated from this activity. Generally, that's split 80-20, 20% going to the general partner and 80% going to the limited partner, and we would, of course, are the limited.
If I can follow up. So the general partner does not put in 20% there of the cash. Their management experience generates the 20% of the profits.
You've actually made two statements, if I may. They do put in cash. Generally, we require, and depending on the partnership, it will differ how much money we require the general partner to put in. The purpose of that is if they have their money on the line also, there's an alignment of interest, so they're wanting, of course, to maximize their personal investment. So that's one portion. They do put in their money, and it actually participates as a limited partner. So they would be receiving that 80%, 80-20 split on their personal dollars into the fund.
But they receive the 20% on their further management part.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Now, the second part of the question involves the concept of nexus. The firms you're doing business with now in Oregon, we are doing business in Oregon, and we have a nexus there, and we tax those, any profits those firms receive. When you are going to contract with a firm outside the state and you become a limited partner with a firm in, say, Washington state, does that firm then qualify as doing business in Oregon since it's only an investor? At that point, is it qualified as doing business in Oregon, and is there a nexus whereby we would tax any profits?
I'm not sure we can answer that. I think that would be that's a part of a revenue question about taxes. I think that the point you got to also keep in mind, what we're trying to do is take that money ultimately and have it invested in the state. It will be invested in the state, which will then generate, hopefully, long-term revenues to the states through taxes and employment. I mean, we're trying to grow companies. So to hear your point, I'm not sure I can't mm-hmm. technically answer, depending on how that is structured, if they pay Oregon taxes on that. just one last point. I mean, using the private sector. I mean, this is something that the Treasurer does all the time in contracting out, finding managers to manage money on our behalf. Again, whether it's the PERS fund, SAFE, Common School Fund, in this case, the Oregon Growth Account. The model has been, we do very little in-house trading. In fact, very little. I mean, we contract almost all of our work out and use the expertise in the financial world to do it. That's what we've done here. In essence, that's what we're trying to do, is expand our horizons so that we can find other partners to partner so we can get more money put in the state. That's the thrust of this, not to be a tax shelter or not to diminish in any way or dilute the investments we're making in the state.
Are you pretty sure?
Yes, thanks.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. I would like, if you could ask that question of Department of Revenue, I'd like to get an answer to that.
Okay, Representative Beck?
I'm curious about Section 3 and the changes made, sort of adding or clarifying some of the Treasurer's policies, and why do we need more specific language there? Where did this language come from? Is this boilerplate from other? And I realize you guys didn't. You didn't introduce this bill, so it came from your predecessor, but just kind of curious as to what this all means and why we're doing it. Or maybe better, how has the Treasurer's office been impeded in doing its job without this language?
And this is my first reading of the language, and I would take it, there's nothing here that surprises me. Mm-hmm. This is how we operate already. So I don't know why the advantage of putting in these words into statute.
I think we're just trying to clarify how we reinvest the money and where we put it back in. Once we, and I think you got to realize too, again, Representative Hill brought the point of, Keith Barnes talked about actually realizing some gains. I mean, we've just started funding these companies, so that it's going to take some time for us to see these returns. Mm-hmm. But then what are we going to do with when we see it? And it's talking about reinvesting so that we continually have a pool of money to work with. And this just outlines how we're going to handle that.
As your earlier example, that these monies would come back in and partnerships, there'd be new investment opportunities, and we want to maintain those disbursements in the pool so we could then in turn reinvest it.
Seems to be adding more direction than currently. Maybe I don't know enough about what the Treasurer's office does, but you know, the line E or line 12 on page 3, other policies. You know, we just want to make sure we're not creating opportunities for future treasurers to be doing things that we later regret. Or I can't. You know, I don't know this statute well, but I want to make sure that a treasurer's not being given more discretion than the board. And I guess I'd maybe someone from the someone can check with Jim Hill's previous staff about where this came from and why, or just allay my concerns that this is just boilerplate stuff and standard modus operandi.
Well, I think, Mr. Chair, Representative Beck, first, if you look on line 3 on page 3, mm-hmm. talking about prudent investor acting, we really are being held to standards about how we manage these monies. And what the new language is addressing is how we ultimately, when we see returns, what we do with them.
Mm-hmm.
And we haven't done that. I mean, we've sort of chicken and egg right now. I mean, we just started putting money in, and our hope and our bet is that we've made some good investments with these companies and that we'll start realizing gains in not too distant future. It's basically boilerplate about how we're going to handle the money as far as reinvesting
that you earn
the principles as we earn it. Yeah.
Okay. Anything else? Okay. Thank you, Representative Worth.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Treasurer. So that currently to date, we have not made any investments in affordable housing projects, the Oregon Growth Fund?
We have not, and we're in the process of looking at some opportunities there.
Okay. Follow up?
Go ahead.
And regarding the guidelines, I guess, for contracting with management companies, given the exemption of the ORS Is there any guidelines as to whether or not when making decisions regarding the management companies to contract with, if Oregon companies are given any preference in the selection process?
May I ask for clarification on that? Are you talking about the selection of the management firm,
right,
or how they invest their monies at the firm level?
Firm.
The selection of the management firms is actually handled by the board, of which the treasurer is the chair.
Right.
And so through that process and the entire fund being focused in the Northwest, you would, as a process of that evaluation, be looking at who is going to best then deploy the capital that's committed to these partnerships to Oregon-focused firms. And so just as a natural outflow of that discussion of how to get that money to Oregon, the partnership that was headquartered here and had the expertise and the contacts, because that's really what you're hiring in the management firm, is their network of contacts, of finding the investments. By default, those firms would be given preference because, of course, that's who's going to meet your goal the best.
Okay.
Go ahead.
And then, where exactly are the emerging growth businesses that we have invested in located throughout the state? Where have those investments been made in Oregon?
I can give an example of in a couple of the partnerships we have in Endeavor Capital. There's a company in Clackamas, Warren Industries, and in Tamarack, Moore Company, and I'm not sure where it's headquartered, but it's here in Oregon.
Are they spread throughout the state? Or are they concentrated?
As far as divisions, you mean, of the companies?
It's the business, well, the investments that you've made.
The mandate on these monies are to look across the state. It's not just in the Tri-County area. While the companies are headquartered in Portland, that's pretty typical. Their look is all across the state.
Go ahead.
On page 3, line 1, it refers to the board having the authority to approve or direct specific investments or strategies for the investment of monies in the Oregon Growth Account subject to investment policies established for monies in the account by the state treasurer. So are those investment policies established and written? And
Yeah, if you'd like to see a copy, we'd be happy to give you those. But yes, I mean, we set up the guidelines by which we're going to make these investments, and that's written by guideline and approved by the board. I just also want to comment on Representative Gerard's question about the exemption from ORS 279. My understanding, because we go into these partnerships, we're working with the private sector, and we're a limited partner in these funds. So I believe the rationale, I don't know the legislative history of the first exemption, but the idea is that you're allowing us to find these partnerships and not have basically tie them to the same laws that we might normally be in under that section, because we're a limited partner. We're a small amount of money in this bigger fund, and want to be able to freely be able to invest in that.
Okay. Representative Worth, are you?
Yeah, that's all. Thank you.
Okay. Representative Hill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On page 3, line 10, subsection D here, it says the determination of when and how earnings are calculated and declared available from the account of the education fund. Is that necessarily a policy? I mean, we've sort of taken I could take this to sort of the extreme, and no matter how great the returns or investments, the state treasurer could say there are no returns, and none of it would flow back to the education endowment fund. It would all stay in the Oregon growth account, because it's just simply the policies established by the state treasurer and the board that exercises through those standards. There's no approval requirement. I understand why. You want to make sure we're in a focus of trying to build up the base in this in terms of to sort of hit critical mass moving forward. But it just sort of seems a strange way to sort of introduce some of these concepts under policies. You know, and it is subjective, so you can do it or not do it. But I'm just curious, and I mean, you're sort of in a bad situation. You guys weren't the ones that drafted this, so or crafted the ideas. I'm just trying to get a sense in terms of how we establish some criteria that the benefits of this ultimately flow to the fund versus sitting around and
right.
could ultimately be chosen not to for whatever purpose.
Well, it may not give you comfort as far as the specificity of this language. I can tell you in practice how many treasurers have served the Treasury for many, many years, in how we work with boards, and it really is in concert with them. And I can't speak again to this specific legislation. I don't know in other portions of statute, in the objective of the fund, if there is a requirement. And clearly we have statutorily how the funds flow in. I can't speak to the statutory intent of the outflow side of it. But the policies that the treasurer sets up have always been in concert and approved by whatever body board is managing those assets. I believe that there is, and again, this is my speculation, why we would have, you've got to house that responsibility somewhere from the standpoint that the treasurer has responsibility in other parts of statute of how they administer this fund, and you could have a board that maybe would go off on a direction that would be contrary to statute. So it needs to be housed, sort of all the pieces coming together in one spot. And that's not a very definitive answer for you, but that's speaking more to the process of how these have been handled in the past.
Follow-up question?
Go ahead, Representative Hill.
Well, I'm reading here that it's. I was just curious in terms of who makes up the board, and so it's the governor appointing the members of the board.
As you can see on again on page 2, line 33, membership one's appointed by the appointed by the governor, and then the terms of the governor of the board membership. Representative Hill, to your last point and question, this was set up as a vehicle to do two things. One, earn money, to make money for the Educational Endowment Fund. I mean, but secondly, or maybe first, I'm not sure what the cart and the horse was, but also to try to help meet this capital gap. So, I mean, I'm very mindful of the mandate that the Education Endowment Fund, as you know, those monies flow out into scholarships, and so, clearly, we're not trying to just build this fund and not keep to serve this other part of basically the purpose of the whole earnings on this. What we're trying to do here is, in essence, to give us an opportunity to continue to look for investments in the state so that the Education Endowment Fund gets returns. And this will take time. I mean, these are, I'm looking at the dates in which these monies were placed. We're talking mid to late 1999. And these are usually 5, 6, 7, 8 years, 10 years before you start realizing the returns that you're hoping that you will see. So we just started this, and really, again, the intent of this was to help make some strategic investments in the state, but also provide some liquidity into the Education Endowment Fund.
Thanks.
Are you finished, Representative? Okay, thank you. I have just a couple of other quick questions. I want to go back for just a second on something that you said that in your answer to Representative Beck that I found kind of interesting, and that is you mentioned, because he was asking about the language on page 3. One of the things that you said is that that's something you're already doing, and I'm just wondering if it's something that you're already doing, why do we want to put it into statute if it's, unless of course it's something that you're already doing without statutory authority to do. I wish something
at which point then there, you know, there's a conflict, and I'm just trying to figure out how we, you know, I just want to make sure that I understand a little bit more of the inner workings here.
Maybe Linda can answer specifics, but again, what we're trying to do is clarify the language and how we're going to handle when we start realizing gains. As I mentioned just earlier, we just started placing the money into these funds. It takes years, basically, to see returns. And this whole program is fairly new. It's just been recently funded, and we're now putting money out. So what we're coming back to you with is clarifying the statute and giving us this authority to help handle the reinvestments. So we're not in conflict because we really haven't seen any reinvestments yet. We haven't seen any earnings off of these monies yet. So the timing is why, that's why we're here today, is to get that authority that when we start to realize it, we have some direction.
And my statement was more broad as far as the activities of the Oregon Investment Council as it oversees the PERS fund and the relationship we have with Treasury. I mean, part of any investment strategy overall, not the actual partnership, but how you structure a portfolio, is where's the money coming from, which in this case it's dictated by statute, from law, et cetera. How you're investing it, clearly we have that within Oregon. And then what's the exit? What do you do with the money once you get it? Because you need to plan for how much is going to be taken away. In this case, it would be going back to the Education Endowment Fund, so moving out of the growth account. The parallel would be in the retirement fund, it would be reallocated to other forms of investment, fixed income, equity, real estate, that type of thing. So that was more my statement of this is the way that we look at the overall planning for any kind of portfolio. So it wasn't directed specifically to this.
Thank you for the clarification. And then never mind, that's already been answered. Okay, great, thank you. Are there any other questions for the treasurer or his staff? Great, thank you very much. Let's see, next up is Jim Craven.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Jim Craven, representing the American Electronics Association, high-tech trade association nationally and here in Oregon. You've had a good hearing on this bill, and I know with some of these historical legacy issues, we sometimes need to get into more than the technical housekeeping language of the bill, and I think that's really good that it had a historical review of this program. We were a strong advocate and worked with then-Treasurer Jim Hill and members of this body back in 1995 to establish this account. I just want to make two comments and say we support the bill and appreciate all your attention to it. One, just to remind folks, because it sometimes gets a little confusing, the Education Endowment Fund, you know, takes 15% of the lottery and puts it in an endowment. An endowment is an investment fund for which hopefully you make earnings and then do something good with the interest with the earnings. All the Oregon Growth Account language does is say, you know, we have to invest the whole Education Endowment Fund. I mean, it's a whole fund, it's 15% of the lottery. Oregon Growth Account just says how you're going to invest a piece of that. So we're not taking lottery dollars for this fund. This is money already allocated by a vote of the people back in the early 90s. So the Oregon Growth Account just directs a portion of how to invest that overall endowment. I don't know how the rest of the Education Endowment Fund is being invested, but this is just a small piece of something. Otherwise, you're investing how you're going to do it, and hopefully do it for the benefit of helping grow companies here in Oregon and such. Second, I believe these amendments are totally in spirit with the discussions we had when we set this up, though I do want to recognize the comments of Representative Hill. I mean, those are all excellent questions, and I hope that, you know, we can work with the Treasurer to get answers to some of those, because certainly the spirit of this original legislation was to leverage funds into Oregon to get people from Sand Hill Road and Menlo Park to come up and put staff here in the state and to be in this state and be looking at investments, and not just to have us be a small piece of the radar screen as they're looking at investments worldwide. So certainly that's the spirit, and I think you heard the Treasurer say that that's going to continue to be the spirit. I think what the technical enlarging the scope does of this bill is say, just like if you're going to go out to get a home loan these days, you know, you can certainly go to local banks, or you might want to look at the internet, or you might want to look at what's available by calling 1-800 numbers around the country looking for the best deal for yourself, whether it's here in Oregon or whatever. And I think that's what the spirit of this bill does, is look for the best deal for Oregon and not dilute the original intent of the legislation. So we support the bill and appreciate your time and interest in the Oregon Growth Account.
Thank you. Don't go away. Are there any questions for Mr. Craven?
I do have one, Jim, and I was looking for the language in here again because somebody brought it up, the 10% of the 15% of the lottery.
Mr. Chair, I do not believe you're going to find that language in here. As we do when we do amendments, the bill will only show the ORSs that we're futzing with, and the underlying statute I don't think is found in this bill, but certainly you can find it in the ORS.
You're right, and I just realized where it was. It was in Treasurer Randall Edwards' testimony about the specifics of that. So, but I do have one other question for you. Now, I recognize that you're not an economist.
Thank you.
So anything you say or say here can and will be used. No, I'm just kidding. What I'd like to find out, though, is it? Do you think, in your estimation, that this will aid? Because you know, being able to take and leverage these funds, the Oregon Growth Account, is this something that you think will help aid in sort of a recession protection for Oregon versus you know the rest of the country? If the rest of the country's economy tends to sort of go in the toilet.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I guess I can't give you that assurance, but having the ability to invest in growing firms in Oregon is certainly a leg up and an assistance. Partly by the growth of this program, not certainly only because of the Oregon Growth Account, but when we started these discussions in 1995 to today, I mean, we've seen a sea change in the interest of investors looking at Oregon emerging growth companies. I mean, we were at the trough in 93, 94. There was almost no venture capital in Oregon and no venture capital companies operating in Oregon. And we have seen, and certainly not all the credit goes to the Oregon Growth Account, but this and a number of other steps have put us back on the radar screen to the tune of hundreds of millions of dollars being invested today in Oregon from venture capitalists. And I might just add that unlike other parts of the country, we have not been the victim of the dot-com boom and bust, as you've seen other places, mainly because the internet companies in Oregon tend to be companies who are building the backbone of the internet. Most of this boom and bust is kind of internet retail types of people, you know, petfood.com and the like. The companies in Oregon that are building the internet are building software for the internet, hardware for the internet, and are doing quite well. So, you know, we've seen a lot of venture capital come into Oregon, but it's been invested in companies that, by and large, are still in existence and not subject to that boom and bust.
Thank you. Representative March.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Craven, you mentioned that we now have venture capital firms coming into Oregon, and that's kind of an expanding business. Is part of that maybe due to us having money available to help venture capital firms invest?
Mr. Chair, Representative March, I think that's absolutely true. Part of it is just the cycle of investment and that the fact that Oregon is on the map is a good place to make investments, whether it's state-assisted or not. But I think the efforts that we did back in the early 90s of our study about the capital gap, which was widely distributed down to Menlo Park, California and such, and the efforts of OGA and a number of other things have aligned to increase the inflow of investments in Oregon companies. Very positive situation today.
Thank you. Any other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Appreciate it. I don't have anyone else on the list for House Bill 2119. Is there anyone else that does wish to testify on it? If not, then I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2119. And committee, there wasn't anything mentioned about amendments or anything to this bill. At this point, I think my intention will be that if there's an interest in doing something or in doing something with this, we'll bring it up again on Thursday for a work session at that time. Okay? Thank you. With that, then, I would like to move into our second bill, which is House Bill. Did I already close the hearing?
Yes.
Okay. Then I'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2116. And Mr. Edwards, would you like to come up and... Oh, excuse me. While you're doing that, Matt, go ahead and give us a rundown on this.
House Bill 2116 has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means and establishes a state stabilization fund. The bill limits the fund to 5% of total revenue in the general fund. It requires a declaration of emergency by the Department of Administrative Services or a 3/5 majority in the Assembly before funds can be used, limits expenditures from the fund to financing public education, health, and public safety, and it dictates the percentages of distribution to those three categories in the event of a declared emergency or a 3/5 majority. And it forbids the legislature from reducing funding for those three categories by more than the state agency average. This bill declares an emergency and would take effect on passage.
Okay. Thank you. Mr. Edwards.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's been a while. for the record, my name is Randall Edwards, State Treasurer of Oregon, and thank you for hearing me on this bill. This is a bill that talks about setting up a stabilization fund. You've heard the term rainy day fund, same thing. What we're trying to do in this bill is to begin to have a discussion with the legislature about how we are able to, as a state, manage our finances in case of a downturn in the economy, largely. As state treasurer, I have been entrusted by the people of Oregon to work and help ensure that the overall financial health of the state is intact. This bill is, a discussion point about how we, I believe, as a state, can bring additional good financial management to Oregon. It would buffer the effects of a downturn on the state's budget and help maintain and possibly improve the state's good credit. In fact, 45 other states in the country have a stabilization fund, a budget surplus fund, a rainy day fund, whatever you want to call it. Oregon is one of the five that does not. As you know, Oregon's economy is and its income tax-based revenue stream is particularly sensitive to underlying economic activity. A slowdown in the economy drastically can affect the revenues available to fund essential services in Oregon like education, public safety, and health, as well as human services. If Oregon does experience an economic slowdown, currently there is no reserve account in our budget to make up any lost revenue by such a slowdown. So either current services must be cut, and they can be cut deep, or additional revenues need to be raised, as we saw in the 1980s. A stabilization fund would allow us to accumulate funds over time so that if we do have, and we will have at some point, I'm sure, an economic slowdown whereby we really have a financial problem. What 2116 does is identify sources of money to be put into the fund and where those money should be spent once they're in once we have an economic slowdown. While I'm not necessarily here to argue the pros and cons of the bill per se, what I am here to argue is that we as a state should have a stabilization fund and move forward on building the constructs of what that fund would look like and how we would use it. I think the points in the bill that are useful, one is the fact that size of the fund, generally speaking, rule of thumb, you look around the country, those range somewhere between 3 to 5% of the general fund. That would be a parameter I'd suggest if we move forward that we'd look at. Another is looking at, and again, the bill is written like many others that have been introduced about using economic forecasting and specifically economic activity over a certain amount of time that would trigger the ability for you, the legislature, and the governor to act on tapping into this fund. The bill is statutory. I think that's another discussion point is do you need to put this in the Constitution or should it be statutory? For the record, we've checked with rating agencies that look at the state's bond rating. They don't have a preference whether or not this is in the Constitution or statutory, which, again, if you had fears about tell other states whether they've had to raid these funds inappropriately, there doesn't seem to be a difference from the financial markets about whether or not this is in the Constitution of Oregon or is in the statutes. Again, I think the point is, rather than dwell on the details, is the fact that we in this body, I believe, need to make a discussion and a decision about whether this session is the session that we set this up. I think you're seeing the effects of already the slowing economy here in Oregon. You have a tough task ahead of you as you're looking into the future and in a couple months about where the state's revenues may be. This is really to help bolster a long-term or a slowdown with which we don't see any ability to immediately turn around and affect our state budget. Establishing this, as I mentioned earlier, could be a good, in addition to good financial management for the state's budgeting process, it also, from my perspective as state treasurer, is something that because we don't have one, it has been an inhibition of ours in the state to get either a better bond rating and or protect particularly a downturn in our bond rating. We currently have a AA bond rating, which is a very high level rating. The highest is AAA. I've been to some firms, Standard & Poor's, Moody's, who rate our state's bonds, talk to them, and one of the concerns they have has been that Oregon does not have a stabilization fund in which we could backstop a return or a change in the economy. So what I'm suggesting to you is, beyond your part in managing the state's finances and resources on my end, particularly with the state's bond rating, having this in place would be a very beneficial aspect to my job in making sure that we have a high credit rating. And just to refresh your memory, what does that mean? What that means is when the state borrows millions of dollars to finance capital projects throughout the state, that we get the best interest or the lowest interest possible on those borrowings. The higher the credit rating, the lower the interest rate. If we see a downturn in the economy, what has happened, for example, in other states, and we've seen this happen here, we can have a downturn whereby if we can't work ourselves out of it, the state's credit can be downgraded, in which case that represents hundreds of millions of dollars over time in interest costs. This has been an issue not only with the economy, but the potential of a ballot measure, which could also affect the state's finances. And I would ask that the committee look at entertaining the idea that, in addition to economic changes that potentially and ballot initiatives can have as equally a shock to the fiscal state of Oregon as much as a downturn in the economy. So you might need to consider as well how you build that into a discussion about what the legislation might look like. Again, I'm here really just to talk to you and encourage you to move forward on creating this fund. And in the end, the tough part will be how do you fund the fund? And I think that's always been the problem that the legislature's had, is how do you ultimately get there. My suggestion is at a minimum you come up with a policy about what you want, what that fund would look like, and then have a simultaneous conversation about how you fund it. I know, Mr. Chair, you have some ideas about how we might do that. There's been discussion about using tobacco money, taking some portion of the general fund lottery. There are ways that you could start to prime this. And again, I want to emphasize this would take years to fill. If we took 5% of the general fund, I don't think there's any way in which you could just, we don't have the resources to just all of a sudden have 5% of the general fund set aside. So I think the strategy would be set the fund up and over time fill the pot and then have that in place. That would be, in my opinion, the best way to go about this. Again, as I want to emphasize, most states have this. We do not. It's something that we desperately need in the fiscal management of Oregon and as we go forward into the century, that we have the ability to absorb changes in the economy, which, as you know, go up and down, and to make sure that we have our house in order. And I'd be happy to answer your questions.
Okay. Great. Representative Cruz?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Treasurer Edwards, it's interesting. This has been my proposed way to create a rainy day fund all along, was do it out of revenue rather than try to do some snaky stuff. And it's also interesting that one of the triggers that would cause us to use this money will probably happen this biennium. Or maybe two of them. So that becomes problematic. I guess I'm curious I mean, there's language in here about what happens if principal exceeds 5% of revenue, but I'm unclear as to where it mandates or requires that basically we build our budgets on 95% of projected revenue. Is that in here at all? So we are in, it speaks to general fund, but it sets no prescribed amount. It just sets a ceiling. Is that pretty much correct?
And again, Mr. Chair, Representative Cruz, as I mentioned earlier, for the record, I'm specifically about the bill. We can debate the mechanics of it, and the way this bill was drafted was to say you, the legislature, have the ability to use general fund money, lottery money, different monies to fund this fund. That's your discretion. And if you want to take what you're suggesting, I think Mr. Chair, the chair has talked about, is to project, you know, taking 2% of the general fund and putting it in and operating under 95% of projected. I mean, that's one way you could do it. That's a decision for you. The 5%, and that speaks to line 8 on page 2,
right?
Talking about once in the future, if we ever hit 5%, what we do with the excess, which would just go back in the general fund.
Okay. Mr. Chair, I mean, this, from my perspective, this is the only legitimate way we ever get to a rainy day fund, is make it part of our budget discussion when we're doing revenue expenditures, rather than to try to carve out tobacco settlement dollars or some unsecured source, which that truly is. So I look forward to the full discussion of this issue, but I like the concept here.
Okay, thank you. Representative Hill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm always skeptical of this is great. We go past it, didn't do anything. We might as well just add, you know, we have to have 100%, you know, people, or, I mean, because in the statutory construction, we can always just pass a bill that says notwithstanding, and we do it with a simple majority. So from a statutory construct, to stick in here any increased numbers of requirements for legislative action doesn't work. I mean, it just, because there's no, we can bypass a statute by just passing another statute. So from that perspective, unless there's a constitutional component here to raise a threshold of requirements, you know, this is just feel good. And I was trying to figure out in terms of how exactly, besides higher education, I was trying to figure out which other agencies wouldn't be able to use this money. We've got K-12 community colleges. We have health, which is a very broad, and we could, you know, run a truck through that word, and then public safety. And so I was just trying to, higher ed is the only one that sort of wouldn't be able to be supported out of the stabilization fund, and just about everybody else would be. And so it's just kind of a strange construct where we try to, you know, let's waive, you know, K-12 and public safety. I didn't quite understand in terms of, again, here where we sort of set out that we're going to, we can't make any less appropriations. It all seems to be stuck on the Legislative Assembly, on the choices that they make, rather than from a budgetary standpoint, where the agencies would come in and the choices that they would make in crafting their budgets in an economic turndown. And so ultimately we will make the decisions in terms of how dollars are spent. If we're delivered a budget, we all know how the process works around here, that it would seem to me that we should be sort of putting the onus at the first of the equation. So we're getting recommendations coming from agencies on how they're going to operate with less dollars before we get here, so that sort of we get stuck with all the bad, you know, and heavy lifting. You know, let's have someone create a budget that makes sense. And so I would agree with Representative Cruz and sort of, you know, that, you know, I think we should be looking at revenue as a means to fund this over the stream, and then the Legislative Assembly simply just needs to have some self-discipline as we go forward
And, you know, in times like right now, we just have to make some hard choices and do take some prudent action to make sure that in the long term that we're going to be in a better position. But I don't see a focus on the agency side here to have some responsibility in terms of an economic turndown of coming forward with budgets that sort of are realistic and sort of saying maybe a test or something that they have to meet to request dollars out of the stabilization fund, and then so that we have some pre-work before we get here. Just a comment.
So there really wasn't a question in there. Okay, I just wanted to make sure.
You can add a question mark if you want.
Yeah.
Well, I think, Mr. Chair, go ahead, Mr. Hill, you're raising the technical points of this bill, and you're raising some ways and means questions. Clearly, we don't know when a recession might hit that might trigger this. It could be after the session's ended. Maybe that'd be good. But if it's before, you're right. I mean, I think the question would be, how do you get the agencies to budget themselves? And there will be somebody from the governor's office who could maybe address that specific question. I think, again, what I'm here to say is those are good questions and nuances that we need to, you and we should be hammering out. The point is, the first policy question is, do you want this? And my answer to that is not want, we need it. And the reason is we have basically a one-legged stool of income, which is very sensitive to the economy, as many of you know. And the fact is, it's not only fiscally responsible, but from my perspective, it also helps us in the long term with our state's credit. So it's a good policy. I agree, you're raising some really good questions about how the mechanics of this would work. And to your point about the statutory sort of feel-good approach, I guess at the end of the day, this is something you'd have to decide. I think the consensus you're going to probably find in this building would be you'd have to go to the Constitution, which that's your decision. I'm not sure. You're right. You could override this with another act. But I think, again, as you know, I think there would be a huge discussion about that. So I'm not sure it would be that politically easy to just raid this.
Mr. Chair, just my comment is we've in the past passed bills and 99% of the members didn't understand what the action was because it was never explained to them. I don't doubt we could pass a bill. My members we just overrid a provision like this. So.
Okay. Representative Corey?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is more a question for you. I think that I don't think there's a person in this room that's going to disagree that establishing some sort of whatever you want to call it, equalization, stabilization, whatever fund is important, but really, the devil is in the details, and I mean, I think it's great that we're having this discussion, but on the other hand, I know that there's a gazillion other bills out there that have similar themes being expressed, and I'm wondering, are we just doing this bill because Randall's here this morning, it's been good to see you, Mr. Treasurer, or are we going to have a stabilization day, or what's kind of the game plan for
That's a good question. What I wanted to do was sort of use this as a way of floating the idea and see what kind of interest there is both on the committee as well as with people in the building and outside the building. I wouldn't mind having a stabilization day because there are other bills coming down the tube that have the same type of a concept. What we may find ourselves doing is having hearings on a number of bills and maybe melding several together into one to kind of come up with a construct that we determine that we like. So I think we have, you know, right now it's sort of an open field in that respect.
Can I have a follow-up?
Yes.
And I appreciate that. I guess that these issues are so technical, and as I said, it's really the details that are important. So I think it would be beneficial for me, and I'm assuming for other members of the committee, instead of just doing kind of piecemeal, one bill one day and one bill another day, if we could have them together, it would help with our understanding of what we're trying to create here. And
I appreciate the comment, and I'll see if we can put together either by borrowing or getting bills assigned to us, and be able to put together a day where we could hear several bills that sort of had the same type of theme. Thank you. Other questions? Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Let's see. On my list here also is Gary Carlson, and then Danny, you'll be up. Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Gary Carlson, representing Associated Oregon Industries. AOI is approximately 20,000 business members from across the state of Oregon, most of them small. We opposed a similar concept to this measure in 1997, but not because of the concept. We opposed it primarily because it was to be seeded with kicker money, which we felt was the taxpayers' money, was money that was not anticipated and therefore was returned and is now in the Constitution. I think it's pretty much off the table in terms of a discussion, in terms of utilization for this kind of fund. We're not opposed to prudence. We support prudence. I mean, who doesn't? I think Representative Corey a few minutes ago said something similar. Restraint is a word that could be applied to this, and I would simply point out that our budgeting process in the state of Oregon has slipped in terms of its prudent person reserve, what it used to be called, I guess, which was an unappropriated ending balance, money that you anticipated receiving but did not appropriate. The guideline used to be 2%. In recent years, it slipped to about 0.5% in terms of how we budgeted relative to anticipated revenues. If you think about it, an unappropriated ending balance really is a rainy day fund, a reserve fund, a prudent person reserve, whatever you want, whatever tag you want to put on it, that's what it is. And it doesn't require a separate fund to exercise prudence. It just requires discipline to exercise that prudence. So, you can put a tag on it if it helps. You put a tag on it, you put it away, say, okay, we're not going to use this unless we really need to. As Representative Hill suggested, need is in the eye of the beholder. If it's in statute, next legislature, whichever legislature finds a need for the money can certainly redraft the measure and pass it or override this measure. We know from our own experience that any pool of money is subject to attack. We have to defend every legislative session proposals to divert unemployment insurance trust fund monies to good causes. That money is to be reserved for people who become unemployed due to no fault of their own, paid for by employers. So these are the kinds of thoughts I wanted to share with you today. We certainly support the need for prudence in budgeting and reserve revenues in the event that revenues turn down from anticipated receipts during a biennial period. I was here. I went through the 1981 recession, depression, whatever you want to call it, and I know you don't want to go through it again. I certainly didn't. We lost 10% of our payroll jobs in this state. That was pretty close to a depression for anybody who lived through it, or certainly who lost their job during that period of time. Mr. Chair, those are a few of my comments. We'd be happy to work with you on development of this concept, if it be your choice to move forward. But thank you for the time.
Thank you. Are there any questions for Mr. Carlson? Representative Hill?
So I just wanted to get on the record. So you're going to be supporting the use of the safe money to spend the rainy day?
I don't think so.
Any other questions? Great. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Danny, we have Danny Santos from the governor's office.
Good morning, Chair Krimel and members of the committee. Actually, it's for the record, Danny Santos, Governor's Education Policy Coordinator. Jean Thorne had wished to be here today. She's the Governor's Education Workforce Policy Advisor. She's testifying next door on another bill. But we just wanted to get on record some of our comments regarding 2116. The Governor supports the need for a state stabilization fund, whether you decide to use that for state government in general or specifically for some educational services. And whereas the state has mechanisms for returning revenues to taxpayers during times of economic expansion, we really haven't developed mechanisms for protecting services critical to Oregonians during an economic downturn. We see this, and we this proposal, and we applaud former Treasurer Hill for bringing this forward. As you heard today, there's a great deal of support for this type of fund. Again, whether you call it a stabilization fund, a rainy day fund, what have you, the governor also has put forth a school stabilization fund, which is up for consideration, House Bill 2299. And as you've heard today, you're going to see a good number of other proposals come forward under this this topic. Among the key questions for any of these proposals, we've listed a couple of them there, and one is the use of the funds. And in that, again, you have the whole range of things that that 2116 proposals, 2299 will propose, but is it state government generally, K-12 education, education generally, public safety, health, as Representative Hill mentioned, there's topics here that you could literally include a whole range of services in. The second point is the maximum amounts to be included in the fund. We have here a 5% of the general fund. The governor in the school stabilization fund includes a 10% of the general fund allocation. And how this to be determined, of course, will be dependent on how it's to be used. The other thing, too, is what will be enough to tide over those critical services that you wish to cover. The other one is a trigger mechanism for tapping into the fund. What's the role of the DAS, the economists? How much of a downturn for what period of time? And what's the role of the voters in this situation? Is it something that should be referred out for their consideration as well? And as Representative Hill mentioned as well, what's the role of the agencies in trying to meet some of their fiscal responsibilities as well? Clearly, the governor has a responsibility to put forth a budget taking into consideration the economic situation and the agency demands, but also the legislature will be obviously responsive to that as well. Lastly, the source of the funds to be put into the funds, and this too is truly a difficult situation as directly you can put general funds into, and as you've heard, there's a lot of other mechanisms that can be considered as well. Ultimately, we find ourselves recommending that if, much like the chair recommends, the idea of trying to put together a work group that could take a look at the entire range of the proposals that are coming forward and seeing what issues arise there, what mechanisms arise there, we support that, and we would be glad to participate in such a work group. With that, those are the comments from our office, and be ready to answer any questions.
Thank you. Are there any questions for Mr. Santos? Representative Ward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Santos, do you know if and where essential public services are defined for the state of Oregon?
Chair Crummell, Representative Worth, I do not know. I can look that up and see if there is a statutory description of those, or if not, where we might find such a description.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Any other questions for Mr. Santos? Yeah? Great, thank you.
Thank you, Chair.
Okay, those are the only two people that I have to testify. Is there anyone else that wishes to testify on House Bill 2116? If not, then at this time I will close the hearing on House Bill 2116. And what I'd like to do, committee, is go ahead and move on to House Bill 2121. And so I'll open the house, public hearing on House Bill 2121. And Matt, if you would give us a rundown on this one, please.
House Bill 2121 has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. It allows the Economic and Community Development Department and the Department of Transportation, with State Treasurer approval, to designate bond trustees and appoint bond councils. The bill eliminates requirement that bond interest be capitalized for 18 months or the estimated period of construction, whichever is less. It totally eliminates that requirement, either one of those. Authorizes continuous appropriation of money from the Oregon Education Fund to the, right now the Oregon Education Fund money goes to the Department of Administrative Services. This bill would just put in statute a continuing authorization of. And the bill takes effect on bonds issued after January 1st, 2002.
Thank you. Mr. Edwards.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Randall Edwards, State Treasurer of Oregon. And again, thank you for the opportunity to come and talk to you about this bill as well. House Bill 2121 is generally a technical housekeeping bill that creates some uniformity among multiple statutes regarding how several state agencies and the state treasurer hire underwriters and appoint bond counsel and trustees for the issuance of bonds. As a side note, the state treasury and the treasurer and Chuck Smith, who's with me today, the head of the debt management division, helps coordinate bond issuances throughout the state on behalf of the state government. So what we're doing here today is to give some clarification about the relationships among the multiple statutes and relating to bonding authority, and then specifically which statutes govern in certain circumstances. Section 8 continuously appropriates money from the Oregon Education Fund, DAS, for public education and education lottery bond debt service. As you know, a few years ago, through ballot measure 52, passed overwhelmingly by the public, the state entered into issuing lottery-backed bonds for educational purposes. Continuous appropriation was inadvertently left out when we created this in statute in 1997, I believe would be the date on that. This bill would correct that omission and allow DAS to pay debt service on lottery-backed bonds without an appropriation from the legislature each session. That, in essence, is the thrust of this bill. It's a technical bill to try to help us manage our state debt, but also how we manage our lottery-backed bonds for education. I'd be happy to answer any questions, and Chuck Smith as well could answer some.
Did you have, Chuck, did you have anything you wanted to add or any testimony to give?
Maybe I should bring up a technical correction that you wanted to ask.
Mr.
Is that all right?
Yeah.
Mr. Chair, you know, we would recommend
your name for the record.
I'm Chuck Smith, and I'm Director of Debt Management for the Oregon State Treasury. Mr. Chair, we'd like to bring up a sort of a clerical correction that we need to make with respect to Section 8 of the bill, which would be page 4, line 2. In the italicized deleted sentences, the first sentence should be deleted. However, the second sentence should be retained.
So where it says the Legislative Assembly may, but shall be under no legal obligation to allocate and appropriate amounts in the Oregon Education Fund to pay education lottery bonds, that should be retained?
That should be retained, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Okay. Are there any questions for Representative Hill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Should this have an emergency clause on it, since keep in mind that this will go into effect January 1 if we don't give it a earlier effective date? So I don't know in terms of which bonds that might occur. The other question is...
we need one after.
Are these statutes specifically related to the OECD department's bonds? Or I'm just trying to understand why we're adding things to call up OECD different. If this is good for the goose, why don't we make it good for everybody and just sort of give blanket authority to, appoint bond counsel? Are these so unique and different or something that we don't have bond counsel on staff, or we get bond counsel all the time from outside? I'm just curious.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hill, the model that the state operates under is the state treasurer approves the appointment of all outside professionals for all bond programs, and that's to ensure professional competence and consistency between bond programs. The Economic Development Department language here is sort of a holdover from a decade or so ago of sort of a past practice. Really, the most efficient model is for the departments to, through RFP process, select and interview bond counsel with the approval of the state treasurer. In this particular language, it was it was specifically directed at Economic Development Department, but really it had the treasurer sort of doing the reviewing and appointment directly rather than the department. But the way we do it with all the other agencies is the agencies do the reviewing. The treasurer reviews and approves the selection. And that's why it's bringing the Economic Development Department in consistency with the other agencies across the state. And that's the reason we're focused here on the Economic Development Department.
Any other questions? Representative March?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. The provision which eliminates the bond capitalization period, the 18 months or estimated period of construction, whichever is less, generally, i.e., it's 18 months or less. These are for construction bonds. Generally, construction periods are not very long, so as it sounds like. So, what's the genesis of taking out that time period?
Mr. Chair, Representative March, construction projects, as you might appreciate, vary tremendously in length. And sometimes some of these projects certainly do run past 18 months. And if they're self-supporting projects, and I'm just going to pick this as an example, let's say it's a dormitory or let's say a parking garage at one of the university systems, it might take a couple of years to construct that. In other words, it might be a couple of years before parking revenues start to pay for this structure. So when you capitalize interest, what you're really doing is just borrowing the interest to pay the bonds back until the enterprise is constructed and the enterprise cash flow starts, and therefore the enterprise is capable of supporting the bonds that were sold for that particular structure, in this case a parking garage. So 18 months happens to be too short for some construction periods, especially of some of these larger projects. And what this simply does is once again allows the state treasurer to approve the capitalization period, just as the state treasurer approves all aspects of bond financing in the state of Oregon. The state treasurer approves and issues all bonds in the state of Oregon, and the legislature deliberately charged the treasurer with that responsibility. So we review these, we take a look at the plans, we take a look at what's going on with respect to these kinds of construction projects, and it just so happens that 18 months is too short for some self-supporting projects to be put into place and have revenues sufficient to pay their debt service.
So with this amendment, though, it could be 25 years. The question is, should we have some sort of cap on this to, you know, keep it in a reasonable length?
Mr. Chair, Representative March, I don't believe we need a cap. First of all, it wouldn't be 25 years because the treasurer wouldn't approve 25 years.
Well, I'm sure Mr. Edwards wouldn't, but, you know,
well,
maybe we won't have an astute treasurer in the future.
we have...
thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative March.
I think in this case, assigning the discretion to the treasurer to set these kind of terms and conditions is the wisest thing to do, to tailor make a bond sale to fit an individual project's timelines. And that's really what we're looking for here.
Okay. Representative Hill?
I think we can come up with some language that, you know, talks about the capitalization period in relationship to the construction and when revenue is going to be generated, so that it gives some boxes to this, but without specifying a period of time, so that we don't get into a situation where we decide that, you know, because somebody says it'll take 5 years to, you know, have something become profitable and revenue to start generating, so we, you know, get somebody to go out and borrow a bunch of money for 5 years, even though the construction occurred in the first 12 months, and we borrowed money to pay back in the hopes that in 5 years some entity would be going. This way we could keep it related back to construction,
okay,
rather than some sort of nebulous, you know.
Maybe a conceptual amendment would be to drop online
34, page 2. Take, just take out, we're dropping the whole section, but just drop out for 18 months. And then the estimated period of construction or whichever is less, so there's a back end on it.
That would be it. Whichever less maybe needs to drop too, wouldn't it? So you shall determine the period of which components.
Conceptual amendment would be strike for 18 months, delete that, and the or, and then so it would read maybe capitalized by four. So we have to insert for the estimated period of construction. Period. Don't know if you entertain conceptual amendments if you're going to work session, but that would be.
We're not going to entertain conceptual amendments because Matt's rear end has a few pieces missing from the last time we did that. So, because of course everything that we do is Matt's fault because he's the administrator. So, what you're saying is we could get do an amendment that would say for the estimated period of construction.
Yes. Good. Yeah. Okay.
Matt can take care of getting that amendment brought in, and then also the amendment on page 4 brought in that would keep that language.
Great. Mr. Chairman, would we like those amendments in one amendment? Would you like them as two separate amendments?
I think if we can do them in one amendment, that would be, wouldn't it? Yes, Representative Hill?
I was just comment on, you know, just an effective on passage, since this is, I mean, it's not going to be.
Nothing. Do you want effective on passage in there? Do you need it?
Yeah, the emergency clause. Those ones. Mm. Yeah, that would be helpful. Yeah. That's a good point.
Okay.
All again in one amendment, Mr. Chairman.
Yes, I think if we can do it all in one amendment, that would be perfect. Because then what we can do is bring it in when we've got the amendments ready. We can bring it in for a work session and go from there. Okay. Okay. Are there any other questions for Treasurer Edwards or Mr. Smith? Okay. Thank you very much. I don't have anyone else signed up to testify on House Bill 2121. Is there anyone who has changed their mind and would like to testify on House Bill 2121? If not, I will close the hearing on House Bill 2121. I think what I will do is that since we only have about 6 minutes left, rather than trying to open another hearing, what we'll go ahead and do is we will hold over House Bills 2117 and 2122 for Thursday. We'll hold those public hearings then. We may have do you think the amendments would be done on, no, the amendments won't be done on 2121. So we'll bring that back when those amendments are ready for a work session.
Chair, if you could tell council that we're going to have it on work session and move the bill out, not that big of an issue.
You would like to make that request, it would probably move faster than I do.
I'll if you'll get that ready for me, I'll make that request. So we can so potentially on Thursday then we would have a work session on House Bill 2121 and a work session on House Bill 2119 along with a few other things. Okay. So with that. I would, without objection, we're adjourned.